From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Michael Goldfarb, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On the surface, it's a shocking story of race in America. Leo Felton, the son of a black father and a white mother, was convicted last week in U.S. District Court here in Boston for conspiring to spark a race war. Felton's history reveals a more terrifying tale. Like thousands of extremists, Felton was indoctrinated by white supremacists while serving time in a state prison, this one in New Jersey. Tonight, On Point, how many radicals are scheming up acts of terrorism behind bars? Do we really have any idea what's going on inside of prisons? We've been looking outside of U.S. borders to identify terrorists and evildoers. Should we be looking closer to home? Join the conversation, On Point listeners, at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I'm joined in this hour first by Thanasi Kambanis, who's the federal courts reporter of the Boston Globe, and he has been covering the trial of Leo Felton and his girlfriend, Erica Chase, who was convicted along with him. Thanasi, why don't you just take us through the basics of the case?
Well, it was a very quick-moving plot that was hatched while Leo Felton was serving a sentence for violent crimes in New Jersey. He, by all accounts, became a white supremacist in prison and met several fellow inmates who plotted Aryan Unit 1, whose plan was to assassinate black leaders, bomb Jewish offices, and provoke a race war, hoping to start riots in the inner cities and to galvanize white males to rise up in favor of racial separatism.
And how did he plan to do that? Why was he trying it here in Boston?
He and his girlfriend, Erica Chase, had begun assembling a fertilizer bomb like the one used in Oklahoma City. They had bought a fertilizer and a detonator and some explosives, and they were trying to finance it by spreading counterfeit money and robbing banks. The idea was they had a 50-kilogram bomb, and they had discussed several targets, including DreamWorks executives, the Holocaust Museum, and the Holocaust Memorial here in Boston.
Now, how apt were they? I mean, when were they intercepted? Did they get very far along in this planning?
Well, in a way, they were very successful, and in a way, they also comically botched it. They were caught passing a counterfeit $20 bill at a Dunkin' Donuts by an off-duty cop. But on the other hand, they had managed to assemble almost all the parts for a bomb. They had a gun, and they had sophisticated equipment to make counterfeit money. And by the prosecution's account, they were maybe days, if not a week, away from having an actionable bomb.
Well, it sounds like they had a lot of help then. They must have had a tremendous network of accomplices, or at least an infrastructure they could tap into to get this stuff done.
Well, Leo Felton had been planning this while in prison. He was very close to the head of the East Coast Aryan Brotherhood, and through him met one of the other cell members who he had never seen face-to-face, but they communicated with letters that they passed through the outside. So when Leo Felton was released in January of 2001, and within a month he was joined by a newly released inmate who was the second member of Aryan Unit 1, and they essentially did all the planning for the plot by themselves with the help of Leo Felton's wife, who, although not a member of the group or does not profess sympathies to it, helped him buy much of the material for his operation.
Do you buy her excuse that she doesn't have sympathies with the group?
She's a different character. She was a heavily devout Christian who married him while he was in prison, and there's no evidence that she shared his sympathies.
Okay. Aren't prison letters censored? I mean, how is it that they were able to share this kind of information so easily?
One of the most interesting things that came out in this case, actually, is how these networks of white supremacists, in this case, use jail mail to communicate with each other. They during the trial, they described a process known as burging, which is
burging.
It's a riff on Jewish sounding lawyers' names, and they would have neo-Nazi literature sprinkled in with legal papers, and they would make fake address labels from firms like Weinberg and Greenberg, and mail in special order materials that they wanted to advance their study of Aryan spirituality and other similar subjects.
Right. Now, what kind of guy, I mean, you watched him in court. What kind of guy is Leo Felton?
He's a fascinating character. From we heard dozens, if not hundreds of pages of letters he wrote, and he has beautiful prose. And he came from a very violent youth, spent 10 years in prison in New Jersey, and he on the one hand, was very controlled and played a lot of part in his own defense, working closely with his lawyer. On the other hand, from his letters, you see a man who was very dedicated to a racialist ideology, and had he would reference Plato, he would reference art from the National Socialist period and interwar Germany. So very erudite and at the same time very violent.
Did anyone in the trial ask him about his own lineage? I mean, he is a mixed race person.
He did not testify ultimately in the trial, and during the proceedings, his mixed race origin never came up. Although that's, I think, what drew many of us to the story, the fact that he seemed to rebel entirely against his own upbringing.
Tell us a bit about that, yeah?
His father was a black architect. His mother was a former nun and civil rights activist. He was raised by his mother and her partner after she divorced the architect. And by his teen years, he had become, by her account, a sort of out-of-control youth and a skinhead. But she didn't see him... particularly clinging to any racist ideology until he was in prison.
But if he was a skinhead, then he might already be on the road.
But there are the non-racist skinheads and the racist skinheads who.
But your view of him, having watched him, is that he wouldn't have been some weedy kid who found himself overwhelmed by the life that behind four walls. But he was someone of his own mind.
Yes, and he seems to be a charismatic leader. And judging by the people he was able to suck into his plot, including the girlfriend who was convicted with him, she met him through prison letters. She was a member of the World Church of the Creator's sisterhood that had a prison outreach program. And only by the sheer force of the letters he wrote her, she ended up abandoning a life she had built in the Midwest, moving to Boston and joining his plot.
And just finally, what was your impression just watching him during the trial?
I think he started the trial with a confidence and a sense that he was on stage, and he seemed to like the attention. By the end, he seemed very frightened when he realized that he'll probably spend most of his natural life behind bars.
Right. I'd like to bring into the conversation now Dr. Brian Levin, who's professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University in San Bernardino, who's in a studio in Honolulu. Good evening, Brian Levin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you've been listening to Thanasi Kambanis fill out the story of Leo Felton. Do you think is he a fairly typical fellow who gets involved in these kinds of activities in prison?
Well, in many ways, yes, and in some ways, no. It's quite rare to find people of biracial lineage or Jewish people in these kinds of organizations, although it's not unheard of. In fact, if you all remember George Lincoln Rockwell, his chief deputy was exposed as being Jewish in the New York Times and a day later shot himself to death. And from time to time, we see, for instance, Jewish skinheads and things like that. But that aspect is extremely rare, and that's one of the things that I think brought such significant media attention to this, not only in the Boston area, but indeed nationally.
Twist, what is the scale of these activities in the nation's prisons? And are they concentrated more in state penitentiaries or in federal penitentiaries?
I would say more in state penitentiaries, although certainly there is a presence in the federal penitentiaries. The problem with regard to the federal penitentiaries is when you get convicted, you're sent to an area like Marion in the Midwest, where you might not have a connection of local people. So it's a lot easier to maintain these in state prison systems, and indeed places like California and Texas and some other states seem to have among the largest numbers. Indeed, the Aryan Brotherhood itself started in San Quentin in the 1960s and have since spread. And in various states, you're probably talking about, for instance, Texas, 400 to 500, maybe slightly more in California, a presence like the Aryan Brotherhood, although the Aryan Brotherhood itself is not the only racist prison gang. One other thing I would say, they tend not to be as structured as some of the other racial gangs that are located in prisons.
Well, what are some of the other racial gangs in prisons?
The Five Percenters.
Who are the Five Percenters?
They're an African-American prison gang. the so-called Mexican mafia, they tend to be a bit more organized.
So out of a total prison population in the United States of what? Two million?
Those, I believe, are the people who are under some form of correctional supervision.
Right.
A good portion of those people are actually not in prison. But to give an example, let's just take Texas. You're only talking about 400 to 500 out of their whole prison system. But that doesn't mean there aren't fellow travelers or people who are loosely aligned. So it's not as easy to put numbers on it as you may think, because it's not like you can take a census. These are all estimates. But the numbers that are actually, you know, hardcore members are significantly lower than those who might be, let's say, associates, but not necessarily full members.
Could you just describe the interchange between those who are on the inside and their support groups on the outside?
That's an excellent question. I'm glad you brought it up. One of the things that we know are that white supremacist organizations try very hard to do a couple of things. First, they try to glorify other white supremacists who are in prison. And in fact, at the top of that list are people who are from the terrorist group The Order. And you'll recall they assassinated radio host Alan Berg in the 1980s. Their leader, Robert Matthews, was killed. But a couple of their members, such as Mr. Scutari, for instance, and another individual, are considered heroes throughout the white supremacist world, both in and out of the prison system. And indeed, Aryan Nations used to put out a publication called The Way, which was specifically targeted for prisoners. In addition, there are other types of magazines as well.
But would the case be that when someone leaves prison, I almost said demobilized, but let's just say leaves prison, is there a support network that he goes into straight away, if he so desires, to continue these activities?
It depends on the group. For instance, the Nazi lowriders are a group that started in prison, but they indeed had a vast network outside the prison system that was involved, for instance, in the methamphetamine trade, particularly in California and those environs. Otherwise, it's probably a little bit more difficult, although you can still go into a mainstream group, for instance, like the old Aryan Nations. Once you get out of prison, it's not unusual for someone to join up with another group, although it's not necessarily the case. Remember, there's a significant benefit from being in an Aryan prison group. There is not that same kind of benefit once you're on the outside, particularly if you're on a parole, because that might violate the conditions of your parole. So if you're in prison, it might serve, and again, I'm not encouraging people to join prison groups, but what I'm saying is there's a rational basis for someone to join these groups for identity and for protection, whereas on the outside, it might actually throw you back in. But certainly there are a variety of groups, like, let me call them mainstream white supremacist groups, that are not based in prison, prisons, that gladly cultivate people who have been in prison. So places like the World Church of the Creator or the National Alliance.
Is this the primary source, do you think, of recruitment for a group like World Church of the Creator?
No.
Okay. Thanasi.
One of the interesting aspects of this Leo Felton case was how much hope his fellow white supremacists in prison took from his activities on the outside. And he linked up with a large support group of sympathizers, both in New Jersey and in Massachusetts, who had either been friends with his fellow prisoners or had been in prison with him. And in the letters they exchanged for the 4 months he was free, they took great heart in the way they expressed it, his waging the war on the outside and anything they could do from the inside to support him, largely by linking him up with people who would either give money or aid or even join his cell.
That's a great point, by the way, if I could just interject.
Go ahead, Brian.
People who have served in prison in the hardcore area of the movement, particularly if they were in prison because of some kind of hate-motivated crime, are considered heroes. And when they get out, they're on a pedestal in those mainstream, outside of the prison groups, if you will.
We're talking about radical racists in our prisons, their activities, being attracted to terrorist activities. On Point, listeners, after the break, we'll be talking about this more and taking your calls. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's prisons as recruitment centers for radical ideologies. Sounds a bit like Oswald State Penitentiary, HBO's Oz, where radical racists of all colors get into conflict, and the mafia stands aside and just watches. We're talking with Professor Brian Levin, who's a professor of criminal justice. We're talking with Thanasi Kambanis, who's recently been covering for the Boston Globe the trial of Leo Felton, white supremacist who's just been convicted of trying to foment a race war by setting off some bombs here in Boston. And now we're going to be joined by Tim Zoll, who's a former neo-Nazi skinhead who teaches anti-hate in Los Angeles and spent time in prison. Tim Zoll, welcome.
Howdy.
Just tell us a bit about your story, Tim. When did you first go to prison?
I was actually not in a state facility. However, I was in a county facility for a year for a hate crime. Prior to that, I was affiliated with many hate groups. I was the Los Angeles area Minister of Propaganda and Recruitment for Tom Metzger and White Aryan Resistance.
Right. When you went off to the county facility, did you probably expected to find brothers there as soon as you walked in the door?
Well, when I was first incarcerated, because of the media coverage of my crime, I was kept in a maximum security area of the facility. However, when I went back, I had gotten bailed out through the trial and whatnot. But when I had gone back in to serve my time, I kept it really quiet, and I was actually in general population. And yes, I was expecting to, you know, be welcomed with open arms and whatnot. And generally, what generally happens in these cases is a young white guy will go in there. Let's say he's not racist. Let's say he's in there for some other crime, not related to hate crimes. And he goes in for, let's say, theft or, drug violations or whatever. Generally, what they'll do if the person looks like they can use him in any way, they might have him be in part of some altercation. Somebody might jump him, or he might get attacked by another race or another gang within the prison, and it's basically extortion. They offer the person protection, and unfortunately, it's a kind of a expected situation, because segregation is pretty much anticipated and required in most prisons, and it's not, you know, done by the guards or anything. It's just a means of protection, because you have so many different racial mixes, and generally white people in particular are outnumbered. So it's even more important for them to stick together, whether they're racist or not. They generally end up having some sort of racist feelings. If they have a slight seed planted of any kind of prejudice, by the time they get out, they're...
That prejudice has flowered.
Yes.
But tell me about you. When you walked in, I mean, you say that you were put in Gen Pop and you kept a low profile. Did you actually get involved in any violence?
I had a few altercations, yes. However, it was covered up. Generally, when an altercation happens, everyone around you will cover for you. It's very easy to.
Well, what was? I mean, did you? I mean, was it an immediate racial altercation?
I'll give you a situation. I was in a facility in San Diego at this particular time. Now, this was not for the racial thing. This is another completely different thing. And there was a skinhead in the facility who had a very loud mouth and was, you know, boasting of his affiliations and whatnot. And he had white power tattooed on his neck. And he had some sort of a problem with the Hispanics in the facility. I don't know what it was about. And generally, whenever something happens, you don't know what it's about. You just do what you feel that you need to do. And what was going to happen to this gentleman is he was going to get basically they were going to kill him. And I went to the leader of the and this was the skinhead didn't even know this, and he didn't even know me. I went to the leader of the group and asked him. I said, rather than you guys, you know, off this guy, jack him, put in work on this guy, why don't you let me try to handle it? And if I can't handle the situation for you, then he's all yours. And what I did is I went up and I asked him. I asked him if he was a skinhead and if he was white power and, you know, the whole scare tactic, and he responded negatively, of course. He was, you know, what's it to you, all this kind of thing. And I told him, I said, well, it's this way. Either he was wearing Doc Martin boots. In this particular facility, he wasn't wearing state boots or anything like that. And there's a thing within the racial circles, especially skinheads, it's called taxing. And it's very humiliating to have somebody take your colors or your boots or your rebel flag or whatever it may be. And I told him to take his boots off. Well, he wouldn't take his boots off, but I threw a little bit of persuasion.
which fist was it?
It wasn't necessarily a fist because he was sitting down. It was a boot across the bridge of his nose. But he gave me his boots, and I took his boots, and I told him that I was going to give his boots to the leader of the Hispanic gang operating in the facility, and if he wanted to cause any further problems, then he could go to that person and get his boots back. Basically, what I was trying to prove to him was that by him starting racial problems on his own, he was threatening and possibly making it bad for the rest of the white population in there. And when you're outnumbered, it's very important that these sort of things are done.
So you were thinking tactically there?
Yes.
And when you left prison, at what point did you drop the neo-Nazi ideology? Was that something that began to happen to you in prison, or was it something that happened to you on the outside?
It was a gradual thing. It wasn't like I woke up one day and said, oh, I'm not a racist anymore.
I guess my question really is, did anything happen in prison that made you begin to question your neo-Nazi beliefs?
No, not within the system. No, in fact, most of my decisions to get out of the so-called movement, which to me is ridiculous in the first place, but it was gradually, and I think to what led to my leaving was that I noticed that I was missing out on life. I mean,
okay.
You know, friendships, and there's, you know, a lot of stuff didn't jive, like the whole Holocaust revisionism. I mean, it's a fact in history. It's a historical fact. The Holocaust happened. You can't downplay it anyway. But the biggest thing that led to my leaving, I believe, was, and it took me a while to get out, I didn't just up and walk away, was one time I was in a supermarket with my child.
Right.
And, of course, this child was raised with hatred being nurtured. And we were in the supermarket one day, and, you know, Dad shopping with his kid, proud father. And I don't know, I think my son was about 2 or 3 years old at the time. There was a rather large African-American man in there shopping. And he pointed at the guy, and he said, "Look, Daddy, there's a big black N-word, and, you know, everyone around heard it. The kid said it very loudly, and he's expecting praise, you know, from his dad, like he did a good thing. And he's expecting some sort of a reward. However, at that particular point, I mean, I had already had, you know, other ideas, other things that led me to not want to be involved anymore. But at that particular time, I was pretty high on the food chain.
All right, Tim, I want to bring a caller in because this is a call-in show as well.
Okay.
And give out the number one more time, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Scott is on the line.
Hi.
My
original comment before listening to some of the conversation was, going back to the beginning of the show, I'm a lawyer now, and at the beginning of my career, I was a federal law clerk in the Western United States. And at the time, there seemed, from our perspective, to be little mystery about A, where the organizations were, and B, how to identify the members, at least within the federal prison system. There are a variety of ways to track that information. At the time, there were either members of the Aryan Brotherhood and related organizations who were regularly filing what they called civil rights petitions or 1983 actions, and there were other prisoners who were being victimized by these groups and would identify in various public filings by whom they were being victimized. I'm not sure where the discussion is going or the objective of the discussion, but that if part of this is to try and understand how to better identify the members of these groups and track their activities to determine the extent to which they are engaging in terrorist activities, monitoring the members of the organizations, which is fairly well known within the federal prison system, and identifying their activities when they leave, really isn't all that difficult from an intellectual perspective.
Okay, well, let me ask Professor Brian Levin to pick up your point, Scott, or just rephrase your point as a question to him. Why isn't there – is there monitoring, and is it effective?
There is monitoring, but it's – there are a couple of things. First of all, a lot of the people who monitor prisoners who are released are overwhelmed, and many of them – know what's going on, but unless it's a major infraction, don't necessarily want to send somebody back into prison because then it might actually make them more of a hardcore bigot. Of course, this varies by who the officer is, but certainly it's theoretically possible to track what people are doing. But particularly today, when much of the hate can come through the mail or the internet, it's a lot tougher, I would say, than it was maybe 10 or 15 years ago.
Tanasi.
Well, even as they know these groups are flourishing in prisons, there's certain First Amendment rights, and a lot of these groups use religious cover to meet within the prison. And that it skirts a very difficult balance because they'll organize as a, say, Nordic religion, the Odinic religion, and then the prison officials have to let them meet, and they can't prevent them from, you know, planning these initiation rituals that involve stabbing minority inmates.
Although, can I just interject one thing on that?
Yes, Brian. Well,
one thing that's been done, for instance, in California, for example, are when a particular prison group gets a designation that it's dangerous, you can do many things. You can segregate its members. You can take the leadership and bring it to other prisons. And this is done in other systems as well. This recently happened with, for instance, the Nazi lowriders who were, up until not too long ago, affiliated with the Aryan Brotherhood. Once they got a designation as a troublesome entity, It was a lot easier to break up their leadership and to segregate their members. So now there's another group, Public Enemy Number One, which is taking their place. So to the extent that a group gets a particular designation in prison as being troublesome, things can be done to them structurally. Also, depending
what thing,
on
what things can be done to them structurally.
Well, as I alluded, for instance, a leader can be transferred to another prison, or members can be transferred or segregated. So there are some significant disincentives to be designated as that kind of troublesome entity in prisons. And that is exactly what happened with the recent downfall of the Nazi lowriders. The other thing is it's not unusual for conditions of probation, conditions of parole to say you cannot associate with X or Y. It's done with the mafia, and it's not uncommon for it to be done with people who are involved in hardcore racist movements as well.
The Nazi? No. Scott, are you still there?
I am.
What do you say to Brian Levin? Do you have any suggestions for even more intensive monitoring?
Well, there, I'll say two things. First, it is hardly difficult from a technological perspective to monitor email, and I don't think there's any debate anymore about the limitations on the rights of felony prisoners. So, and without suggesting that anybody broach their First Amendment rights, it strikes me that there are a number of ways which the government currently uses to monitor the activities of others that can be employed here. And really, I'm not talking about actually some of the structural things that Brian is suggesting. If, as I said before, if the goal here is to monitor those groups and the individuals within those groups who are likely to commit terrorist activities, and I segregate those from the mafia, the Mexican mafia, some of the other organizations that are better organized and are more business oriented, it's not difficult to do that if that's the objective. But you have to, you know, the Brian made the comment before about resources. There's no doubt about the fact that there's a lack of resources. But if we're going to refocus, if the nation is now refocusing on terrorism, there are ways to track the terrorism coming out of some of these groups that are in prison.
Okay, Scott, I want to thank you for that call, and we're going to pick up your point after the break. Tim Zoll in Los Angeles, thank you very much for joining with us and telling us your story. You are listening to On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb.
From Boston University,
I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. Just before the break, we were talking with a caller named Scott who made a strong point about being able to monitor these activities. I mean, these are hardly secret. Brian, why aren't networks, the various networks, more thorough? I mean, leaving aside resources, are there any legal questions about, I don't know, First Amendment issues that prevent the government from actually doing some serious intercept here?
Well, are you talking about people who are in prison or once they depart prison?
Well, there seems to be a fair amount of intercourse between people inside and people on the outside. And that, you know, there's a transition period they go on the outside. And we were talking earlier about whether or not they carry on their activities or how they carry on their activities. But let's talk about on the inside.
Well, certainly the Supreme Court has been quite clear in saying that the rights of prisoners are not the same as those outside. However, there was an excellent point made that with regard to religious practice, authorities in prison have a lot less latitude, and they do have to allow for the free exercise of someone's religious beliefs to the extent that it does not disrupt the prison operations. And that is something that was alluded to before the break, which is that many of these individuals are saying that they belong to Christian Identity, which is a hardcore religion of white supremacy, which says that Jews are the spawn of Satan and blacks are subhuman. So you have people who are shrouding their membership in these groups by saying, well, we belong to a particular religion.
Is there no way of just exposing that for the sham that is?
Well, we might regard it totally as an offensive belief, but nevertheless, it is an actual religion. And you run into problems with other groups as well,
As we circumscribe inmates' rights, these groups are very intelligent about finding where the breaches in the wall are, so to speak. So some of these groups, like the National Alliance and the World Church of the Creator, actively advise their members to incorporate as a religious group in prison, and similarly with the Berging, to use the attorney-client privilege, since prisons can read your mail, but they can't read the mail from your lawyer. They found that way around it, and presumably they'd find other chinks to in the armor to get through if these gaps were closed.
Well, that's a grim prospect to think that there's always a way out.
Well, it's a small and dedicated group, and presumably in this polarized world they live in, it's a form of their identity that they cling to pretty passionately.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Joe is on the line.
Good evening.
Hi.
I was a juror on the Felton trial, and driving home tonight, I heard you introduce the subject, and your reporter who spoke about sitting in on the trial made what I thought were a couple of factual misstatements regarding the evidence that was submitted at the trial.
And they are?
Well, number one was he said that the issue of Leo Felton's race did not come up. One of the exhibits that was submitted into evidence at the trial was a evidence report of items that were found during a search of his apartment in the North End on 59 Salem Street in the North End, and it clearly stated evidence report that his race was "quote unquote" black. And so I think that, although there wasn't an overt discussion of his racial background, it was mentioned at trial and it appeared in evidence.
Joe, we're coming actually to the end of this discussion, but so long as I've got you on the phone, what I'd really like to know from you is what you think about what you've learned as a juror about these organizations in prison. Are you concerned about their size or their strength?
Of course, I was warned by Judge Gertner not to read or study this matter while I was considering the evidence and acting as a juror. And in fact, I want to specify that I served as an alternate. There was a jury of 16, and there were four alternates. I was one of the alternates, so I didn't actually vote on the verdict.
Are you concerned, though?
Yeah. Well, yes, I am concerned, but I'm also concerned about government prosecutors using conspiracy laws against people who are really exercising free speech. You know, the other misstatement was that a bomb was created. There was no bomb, and very flimsy evidence of a
I didn't
bomb.
Hold on. Thanasi just wants to defend his work.
I didn't actually say a bomb was created. I said that they had assembled most of the constituent parts of a bomb and were a week away from, according to the prosecution, from having an active bomb.
Yeah, the prosecutors did a good job. I have to commend their lawyering, but really the facts were very scanty on that, whether or not there was a bomb or an intent to make a bomb. These two folks, of course, in my view, are bad people and deserve to spend some time, perhaps a good long time, behind bars. But I think the government got very lucky on that conspiracy conviction.
Okay. Joe, thanks for your thoughts. We're coming to the end, as I said. And I just want to put a final question to Brian Levin and Thanasi Kambanis. Do you have any concerns that since September 11th, that there might actually be increases in activity on domestic terrorism breeding in prisons while law enforcement and the government are looking overseas?
I have a concern, but not necessarily of an increase. One thing that I think the Felton case proved, and I'll be very contrite so we can have the reporter speak on this, is that you don't need a lot of people to do this. And what these groups, these hate groups do, is they don't orchestrate acts of violence as much as they encourage people who have violent tendencies and some kind of vulnerability to act out on their own. They call it propaganda of the deed or leaderless resistance. And that's what I worry about. Not that they're growing by leaps and bounds, but there are enough people out there who are ticking time bombs who might just act on it. But I felt that way before September 11th.
And this group, this Aryan Unit 1, was actually arrested before September 11th. And there has been some concern that federal law enforcement will displace resources from domestic terrorism. But the units of the FBI that monitor this are apparently still at full strength, so they tell me, and are watching for domestic terror, which they think is probably a serious threat as foreign terrorism, given that they're already in the country.
I want to thank you, Brian Levin, Professor Brian Levin, Director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University in San Bernardino, for joining us in this hour. And also thanks to you, Thanasi Kambanis, federal courts reporter for the Boston Globe. The federal courts here in Boston have had a fair number of these bombing-type cases recently. I hope you don't have to cover too many others. You can continue the conversation online, log on to onpointradio.org, and click on forums. In a moment, rebuilding an Afghan village. This is On Point. Correspondent Sarah Chase is On Point's Eyes and Ears in Afghanistan, bringing us voices, sounds, and stories from the Afghan street. In this week's diary, she takes us to the small southern Afghan village of Akolecha, which was largely reduced to rubble during the war against the Taliban. The villagers in Akolecha are now scrambling to rebuild their houses and their water supply before winter comes.
Two young men, Fazil Mahmud and Dad Mahmud, squat in the dun-colored dirt by the road that slices through the southern Afghan desert between Kandahar and the Pakistani border. There's a length of pipe at their feet 5 inches in diameter. They're tightening bolts at the joints that hold it together. With this pipe, they're going to bore a well into the parched ground. Their rudimentary machine works like a pile driver, hauling the pipe up and letting it slam down, pounding and pounding till the hole's the required depth. That they are sitting here preparing to begin work is the result of a difficult compromise hammered out between immediate needs and the luxury of long-term planning. Akolecha, the village whose well this will be, is like dozens of others around here, low-slung mud brick houses seeming to cringe from the glare of the sun, their walls blending in with the desert around. A few pomegranate trees and some grapevines providing a fringe of green. Much of Akolecha was reduced to rubble during the U.S. bombing campaign against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. It was at the very end of the war. Al-Qaeda remnants were putting up a furious last stand at the nearby airport. The villagers had long since fled, leaving their houses empty for Al-Qaeda forces to hide out in. The bombing was withering in those final days. Now Al-Qaeda is gone, but so are half Akolecha's 30 families, who are now homeless. Last spring, as a personal gesture, citizens of the town of Concord and others collected more than $18,000 to rebuild the houses of Akolecha, a way of proving that what President Bush had said was really true, that the war had not been against the Afghan people. The idea was to build not only houses, but a bridge, another Concord bridge, between a small American town, albeit a symbolic one, and an Afghan village. In early June, engineer Abdullah and our office manager Qasim and I went out to do a rough survey of the piles of disintegrating rubble. The venture turned into a kind of bargaining session.
What did he say?
He said with this room, six room, rooms with this pipe.
Here's the thing.
How many rooms were we going to build in this house? Would we repair this cracked ceiling? And there was another thing. Akolecha's water had run dry. The trees were dying. They needed a well. This seemed like the perfect kind of project for USAID, the overseas development arm of the U.S. State Department, which is concerned with winning over hearts and minds in southern Afghanistan. I know of no other project here that's been taken on by ordinary American citizens with the energy and enthusiasm and goodwill that Concord has poured into Akokalacha. So we submitted a formal proposal to USAID with a line-item budget for a 70-meter well. We put in for drilling, filter pipe, a submersible pump, a generator, a watchman, a switchboard, a pump station, the works. We were told we were a shoo-in. But in the intervening 6 weeks, the big donor's policy has changed. No more wells, we were told, because the whole region is too dry. Wells will only draw down the water table further. There needs to be a strategic plan. I agree. In fact, we've submitted another proposal to conduct a 6-month study of the water resources here with an eye toward developing that strategic plan. But in the meantime, Akokalacha needs a well, or it will simply vanish. But no donor would touch it. So at length, we've decided to use some of Concord's money for a small well with a hand pump. At least that will provide water to make mud bricks for the houses and drinking water for everyone. 2 days ago, I broke the news to the village elders. They had spread out mats for me and brought grapes, tiny purple sweet grapes, in a basin of water. It was rough going. But the governor's going to give us electricity, they told me. We need a submersible pump. I tried to make them see the drawbacks. In a year, with an electric pump, their big well would run dry.
I think we should say that to them again. Submersible or turbine sounds good now, because you imagine how... Because you imagine how much water will come out of it. But you're not thinking, you have to think into the future.
God will bring rain, they replied. So now it came down to it. They were simply not going to get a big well, not from me anyway. Faced with a decision, their arguments collapsed quickly, as their houses had done under the bombing.
We want to dig a well, we want to drill a well so that everyone in the village can have drinking water. These wells are in private property.
I suddenly realized these villagers had been bargaining up, that was all. Just as, in its own way, the international community is bargaining up. USAID and its British counterpart say they won't do any more village wells because they need a grand scheme, a 5 or 10 or 20 year plan, and they're right. But for the past quarter century, the people of Afghanistan haven't had a future to think about. And now, conditions for many are so dire they can't afford to think about the future. What matters to them is right now. And what the Akokalacha villagers were doing was trying to leverage for as much as they could get, right now. And right now, a small well is better than none at all. When will you start? The elders asked me. Winter is coming in 2 or 3 months and we need our houses.
Sarah Chase is On Point's Afghanistan correspondent. She works in Kandahar for the NGO Afghans for Civil Society. I'm Michael Goldfarb, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by...